thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to That Great Business Show, episode 36 of Ireland's best business podcast, brought to you, as always, by the world's best shaving oil company, DeFactoShave.com. I'm Conal O'Moran. We know insolvency doo-doo is likely to hit the fan in a big way when we shortly get back to trading normality. Well, it may only be a decade late, but the government is hoping to have special legislation around insolvency for smaller companies in place by summer, like very, very soon. We have the expert here to tell us what to expect. Clothes retailing is a game of roulette when you have to second-guess fashions, seasons, the weather, the economy, and. But we found a clever piece of Irish-made software that could remove some of the gambling out of the business. And if only I had a euro for each article I've read about what work will be like after COVID, I'd be a happy man indeed. As normality beckons, we're joined by someone who has been in the flexi-time business for decades, so he should actually know what the future will look like. And of course, we deliver for Team GBS on That Great Business Show. As promised from episode 35, we have introduced Norman Crowley to Conor McEnroy, who joined us on episode 15. And I know from De Facto founder Tom Murphy that he, as promised on the show, has been in contact with Samantha King of King Hair and Beauty, all to do better business. That's what makes us different. Team GBS is a real community of great businesses supported by another great business, DeFactoShave.com. And if you want to join our community, the door is wide open. Tell us about your great business on LinkedIn. Our numbers have doubled there in the last few weeks. And if SMEs are your target, why not advertise with us? We're open for business just like you.
That Great Business Show.
Some of you may be old enough to remember an RTE radio program featuring the late Frankie Byrne. She acted as agony aunt to the nation, and her catchphrase was, "It may not be your problem today, but it could be someday." No business can foretell the future, so saying that insolvency won't touch your business life or that of your friends in business would be trite. So insolvency may not be your problem today, but it could be someday, and there are big changes coming down the tracks that could have a very, very big impact on what happens to smaller insolvent companies. Declan De Lacy is partner at PKF Accountants and joins me now. Declan, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you.
This legislation, more than 10 years in the making, it's expected to be passed by the Dáil this summer. And yet, after 10 years, it's still in many areas, not all areas, many areas, clear as mud.
Yes, it is. I would argue that it's not 10 years in the making. I'd argue that the issue was ignored completely for 9 years and that it was only the pandemic and the obvious difficulty that was going to create for businesses that has prompted government to look at this issue. So it was only last September or thereabouts that the CLRG took a look at this. That's the Company Law Review Group. And since then, things have moved at an extraordinary pace, but not as extraordinary as was the case back when examinership was introduced over a weekend to rescue the Goodman Group.
One thing which is extraordinary is there is a whiff, more than a whiff, there's a stink of anti-small business in what is being proposed. It's small businesses are going to be made pay to be small businesses, and larger businesses, and particularly the state, is going to get away with bloody murder.
Well, that's not really a question, is it?
This is the podcast.
Yes.
And I love it because actually I can make some points of view.
Sure. Well, I suppose I have a point of view on that as well. I think I would agree with you to a very large extent that when framing this legislation or drafting it to the extent that it has been drafted so far, it does seem that there has been an inherent prejudice against the owner of the small business by comparison with the owner of the very large business. So, for example, revenue are in some, although not all circumstances, going to be excluded from these schemes. There's going to be a requirement that the administrator of these new rescue schemes report to the ODCE on the conduct of the directors of the business. There are things that don't exist in examinership. And I think if you look at the history of the last, well, for as long, far back as you want to go, there's certainly good evidence that the directors of large businesses can do just as bad things, if not worse, than the directors of small businesses.
Yes, they can. And do they get away with it?
Usually.
Yeah, that's the problem. Another thing I saw was I thought this was going to be relatively cheap. It is relatively cheap. It's still going to cost an awful lot of money. So, and I still can't ever get my head around, you're insolvent and yet you're expected to pay the insolvency practitioner. Well, somebody has to pay him or her. But if you're insolvent, where do you get the money?
Well, really the burden of the cost of any insolvency process is borne by the company's creditors. So in a liquidation, there's a pot of whatever it might be. Very frequently little, and what's available goes first towards the cost of the process, and what's left is available to pay the creditors. It's generally not the directors of or the shareholders of an insolvent company that put their hand in their pocket to pay for the process. Usually, it's the process putting its hand into the creditors' pockets by. Through a reduced distribution to them that pays for the process.
That assumes that there is any money, but particularly with startups, for example, that have gone and become insolvent, there's nothing at all. It's theory. And yet, if entrepreneurs want to go back into business, they have to do the orderly wind up.
That's right. That's right. And that needs to be paid for. And in the absence of there being any assets, it is inevitably... the directors are the only people who are in a position to pay for it. Unfortunately, it's all too common that companies aren't wound up in an orderly way and that the directors simply walk away from them. That creates all sorts of problems for employees, especially who don't necessarily get their redundancy or arrears of wages, which they do get in situations where an insolvency practitioner is appointed. And I've had a few cases where trade unions told their members to contact me to get a company put into liquidation where it had been abandoned so that their claims could be processed. But I suppose that's a whole separate issue to the one that we're talking about here today.
Well, I am told that you know more about this issue than anybody else on the island, and maybe you just give me three big headlines to scare the bejesus out of the listeners to say, this cannot be happening. This cannot be true, because I gather from you and what you've been writing about is that there are a ton of these issues. What are the big three, big five, big ten, whatever number you want?
Okay, well, I don't want to scare anybody, but I do think there are big issues with this process. I think it's worth describing what the process is. And in essence, it's a process that allows a company that is in difficulty to negotiate some sort of a settlement with its creditors as a body rather than individually, that allows them to continue trading and hopefully to provide for the employees and the owners and the creditors through whatever means over a longer period. So that's a useful process. It exists in the form of examinership for larger companies. It hasn't existed in reality for smaller companies up until now, simply because examinership costs over 100,000 usually to do.
So that's laughable when you're down at the SME level.
Exactly. It just isn't affordable. So this process is designed and intended to replicate as much of examinership as possible. At least that's the stated intent of it. The original drafts of it, or the original descriptions of it that we got from the minister, had huge holes. So, for example, there was no mention of leases in the original announcements.
Which would mean that one of the reasons that so many businesses probably will go insolvent is that their rents are way too high.
Exactly.
And therefore, they're caught on the lease, mm-hmm. and yet it's been left out. What kind of thinking, what lack of basic business knowledge put that or left that out?
Well, if you look at the original report from the Company Law Review Group, there were two thought processes in the room. One of them was that it was essential that a provision for dealing with leases be included. And the other one was that dealing with leases was too complicated for a scheme designed for SMEs. Now, to my mind, that grossly underestimates the competence of SME directors and their advisors.
Who have taken out a lease, so they found out about a lease in the first instance, signed off on it, and yet it might be the thing, nobody's fault, that is crippling them.
Well, it often is the case. And in a situation where you've got a lease that you signed up to 5 years ago and the market has fallen, if your neighbours are new entrants and they have lower rents, or if your neighbours are larger businesses and they've gone through the examinership process, then they're likely to be paying lower rents than you. Now, if you're competing with them, you're going to be at a great competitive disadvantage because your cost base is going to be higher than their cost base.
So look into your crystal ball about the lease issue. What's going to happen?
Well, the lease issue was identified in the CLRG report, completely omitted from the first announcement by the minister on the shape the scheme was going to take. As you know, I wrote a piece and identified some of these issues. And a couple of days later, the minister had another announcement where he indicated that there would be a process within the SCARP bill to deal with leases. So,
now, much as I admire you, and I say it again, you are meant to be the island's expert on this area. Mm-hmm. Is the government, or sorry, are the public servants taking their cues and their knowledge from bits that you've written for the Sunday Indo and for the newspapers?
I hope not.
Well, that's what I'm just wondering.
Well,
is it really down to that? I'm looking at this and I'm kind of aghast.
Well, it's possible. Certainly, this is something that had been identified in the CLRG long before I raised it.
But you raised it and suddenly, whoa, something's changed. That is good for you. Obviously, it's good for us because it's happened.
Yes, yes.
But my God.
I think, to be fair, I'm not the only one who raised it. It was an issue raised by ISME. It was an issue raised by the SFA. And I think there was probably a clamour amongst people involved in representing small businesses. And the minister simply had to answer it.
Which appears to be happening, but we yet to have to see the details. Not right, the devil being...
We haven't seen the final detail, but we have the draft heads of the bill. And what that provides for is a process whereby if a lease... If it's essential to the survival of a business that a lease be... terminated, then the company or the insolvency practitioner involved can make an application to either the Circuit Court or the High Court with a view to terminating the lease. And in that situation, the landlord becomes a creditor for the capitalised value of the loss of rent.
Going to the High Court,
yes,
is going to cost an awful lot of money immediately.
It will indeed.
And I presume you're talking about seniors and juniors and all my other learned friends, and or are we looking at another? Say we can get away with 10 grand.
Yes.
The application to the High Court, is that going to cost you 10 or more thousand?
I would expect it should be possible to do it for less than 10. It's impossible to say.
Yes, but very unlikely because I never do it for less than 10.
Well, no, you're right. You're right there, but I suppose my firm, and I'm sure other insolvency practitioners and are talking to lawyers, solicitors and barristers at the moment, and having a discussion about this and saying, well, we're going to have a bundle of these and we want you to make this formulaic and just we'll agree a price with you for the next 20 of them.
You have many, many pieces of paper against your name, one of them being that you are a trained lawyer as well, correct?
Well, I have a degree in law.
Degree in law.
Yes.
You know enough lawyers that that's just not going to happen. You know that they don't. They will not agree. Be real. We try to talk.
We're very persuasive.
I try to keep it real here. So, yes. You know, that's another thing.
You're absolutely right. The cost is going to be significant.
Yeah, so we park the insolvency, not the insolvency, the lease, because that's a red flag.
Yes, of course.
Next one.
Yes.
What is?
The next big issue here was the approval process. In fact, there's a couple of big issues, and we can deal with any one of them. So with the approval process, you've got the issue around what we call cross-class cram-down, and then you've got the whole
what?
Issue. cross-class cram down.
I'm glad she didn't have a few drinks before coming in.
No. And then you've got the whole issue around state creditors.
You get onto the state, because
we'll get onto the state
creditors. This drives me nuts.
Okay. So the situation with state creditors is in examinership, which is the process that this is intended to replicate.
For a smaller company. A poorer company, really.
Yes. In examinership, the debts owed to the revenue or to the Department of Social Protection or to any state creditor that ranks in priority in liquidation, and all of these creditors do rank in priority in liquidation for certain amounts. In examinership, they can be written down in precisely the same way as any creditor, subject to the rule that they get no less than they would get in a liquidation.
Can I show off?
Yes, of course.
It ranks pari passu.
Yes, it does.
I studied law too.
Okay.
Go on. So back to...
In the scheme we're dealing with here, which is the small company administrative rescue process, or SCARP, the intention is, at the moment, that revenue or state creditors, as they're identified, will have the option to exclude themselves on a number of grounds. Now, those grounds weren't identified until the most recent announcement.
Did you write another article about that?
Well, no, but there was quite a fuss kicked up by a number of people, and I was amongst those people. So, subsequent to that bit of a hoo-ha, the minister's announcement indicated there would be a series of grounds on which a state body, by which they mean the revenue, can exclude themselves from the process. And these grounds are that there's tax returns, or there's issues subject to appeals, there's some sort of an audit or investigation ongoing, and they're fine. I mean, I don't think anyone would take an issue with them. The one that possibly creates a difficulty is that the company has a poor history of tax compliance. Now, that's a very subjective term.
Correct.
And in most cases, a company that is insolvent hasn't been able to pay the last VAT return or the last PAYE return. And in the vast majority of cases, regardless of whether companies are solvent or insolvent, on a going concern basis today, they've warehoused their tax debts the last year. So are they companies with a poor history of tax compliance, or are they not? I would say the likelihood is that a company that has warehoused its debt will be regarded as having not a bad history of tax compliance. But there is a judgment to be made by somebody in revenue as to whether a company has a good or a bad history of tax compliance. And
so they are adjudicating on themselves.
They are. And
that's not right.
It's not right as a principle. In practice, and I think we've got to go beyond the theory here and look at how this is going to actually play out in practice. Minister has said, and the revenue have said, that they're going to adopt a reasonable approach to this. They're going to adopt largely the same approach that they've adopted in relation to the personal insolvency schemes that were introduced a decade ago or thereabouts. And in those schemes, they've engaged constructively and been quite reasonable. So if we have a similar approach to there, then I think we can all go forward with this and say, well, revenue are taking as reasonable approach as anybody could ask for. And the system can work. But I think the underlying principle of revenue having or any creditor indeed being entitled to just opt out is questionable.
And it's also open to abuse in Ireland.
In Ireland, but I think certainly the revenue would tell you that they won't abuse the process.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on. Third point, the third big red light or red flag, whichever.
Sure. Again, at the start of the process, this is something that really concerned us, was the actual method by which one of these schemes became binding. So you're going to have, you know, a discussion period with your creditors. Then you're going to put a plan to them, and then you're going to invite them in to vote on that plan. And some of them will vote in favour, and some of them inevitably will vote against. And the process by which it becomes binding was the issue, and the question of whether that required an application to the court or not. The CLRG, in their report, were of the view that it could potentially be done without an application to court, but they didn't recommend it. They left it within the minister's to make a decision on public policy grounds as to what the most appropriate way was. But they did recommend that wherever a creditor objected, that the company would have to make an application to the court. Now, of course, there's going to be a creditor objecting in every case if they don't have any, if it's not at their own risk. If for no other reason than if somebody is owed less than the price of going to court, it's open to them to say to the directors or to the insolvency practitioner involved, unless I get paid in full, you're going to have to go and spend that money on going to court. And they might have they might be doing better than they would in a liquidation scenario, and as well as all of the other creditors in the same position, but they might still want the extra bit, and the burden of that will ultimately fall on the other creditors. So that's unfair on other creditors. And this is something that I identified. I had a meeting with the minister with the SFA a couple of months back and mentioned it to him then. The original drafting or the original description of the scheme as it came out kind of fell down, we felt, on that. But the most recent version that was announced last week provides that if a creditor objects, then the court will schedule a hearing to determine whether they've been unfairly prejudiced.
More money.
Well, hold on. The burden of proving that they've been unfairly prejudiced falls on the objecting creditor. I think that was some good drafting on the part of the minister's team.
So does that mean that the objector, if he, she fails,
yes,
do they pick up the tab?
They pick up their own costs.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of puts a little bit
of manners on them. Okay.
If their objection is manifestly unreasonable, or groundless, then the company or the insolvency practitioner supporting the scheme really has very little to say in court. So I think that's gone from being something that in the first iteration of this process was a disaster to something that's not perfect, but is very workable.
Maybe you can't answer this, but I'd be interested in finding out, how does our legislation in this area compare, say, to the UK or to other similar countries?
We've gone a slightly different route to the UK.
Better, worse, cheaper, quicker?
As an insolvency practitioner, I think this scheme, if it's brought through in the way that's being described now, even with all the faults and even with all the warts, is probably better than the scheme that was introduced in the UK last year, which at the time, I would have argued we should have just copied chapter and verse into Irish legislation.
That's good news. Mm-hmm. That's something positive. Now, you really do have your finger on the pulse. There are 250,000 odd SMEs out there. I think from having a chat with you that you don't reckon we're going to see any huge insolvencies for maybe 9 months, 12 months, 15 months into the future. After that, mm-hmm. have you any idea, and I'm asking an impossible question, as to the level of insolvencies? You see scare headlines, 10, 20, 30,000 companies could go.
Well, if you want your scare headline.
Yes, please.
Your scare headline is that, based on figures released by the central bank, more than half of SMEs had run out of cash 9 months ago. Now, the supports that have been available haven't replenished the cash. They've maybe kept the lights on. But whether that's going to result in a tsunami of insolvencies or not, I don't know. I don't think that it's going to be that dramatic. Certainly, I think over the next 6 or 9 months, as the supports fall away and the effect of that becomes apparent, there's going to be a significant increase in the number of company directors who are looking at their situation and asking the question, can I continue?
Because, of course, that big sword hangs over them trading insolvently or trading recklessly.
Yes, if they trade recklessly, then they can be made personally liable for the debts of the company. And that's not a theoretical thing. That does actually happen. You rarely hear about it because it's more usual that those cases get settled and the directors simply put in what they can, but that's what they have.
The final question, I suppose, on this one is if there were 30,000, take a number, a tsunami.
Yes.
There's no system that could handle that. Certainly not one of ours. We can hardly organise a tea party. There's no way. So what happens? There could be a queue longer than the vaccine queues every day of people trying to, you know, get through the system.
I think if you look back to 2010, 2011, 2012, when we got up to sort of 1,300 or 1,400 insolvent liquidations a year, I think that's a level that's likely. I think back then, as may happen again, there will be a large number of companies that cease trading whilst insolvent but go through no informal insolvency process. And that puts the directors of those companies at a huge hazard.
And can they continue trading in another company?
They ought not to.
But do they? I mean, Irish style.
It does happen.
And are they actual formal directors?
Yes.
Is there not joined up thinking somewhere?
No,
insolvent there is. John Smith is gone, but the other John Smith with the same address happens to be trading away.
And this is where the hazard arises. So a creditor of the original insolvent company gets upset about it, as inevitably they will, and you can't underestimate the possibility that creditor might be their revenue or the local authority or even an employee who hasn't been paid their arrears of wages and holiday pay and redundancy money and all of the other amounts that they're supposed to get. And they make an application to the court for the appointment of a liquidator. And the liquidator then identifies this is something that has happened and I suppose looks to make those directors either restrict them or disqualify them or most significantly make them personally liable to the debts of the company.
Oh dear, come here to me. I have to ask you your final question. Hire in a heartbeat. Who would you like to have on Team PKF or Team Declan de Lacy?
I'd definitely hire Napoleon Bonaparte if he were available to me, because there's a man who doesn't take defeat.
Doesn't take prisoners.
No, well, he doesn't take prisoners, but you know, if things go wrong, he just deals with it, moves on and starts again. But he's not available, unfortunately. So you asked me for somebody real who might actually be available. And Dermot McArdle, ex of Anglo, is a terrific fellow who I've worked with on and off on different things over the years and who can turn his hand to anything he decides to look at.
I don't think I've ever met or heard of Dermot McArdle, but that's lovely to hear, is that I love these kind of hidden gems, people who are hidden gems and who are probably out there digging away, helping other businesses as we speak. Oh dear, Declan, I think we may be having you back. No, I don't mean, shouldn't be saying, oh dear, Declan, we may be having you in again because, oh dear, the doo-doo is going to hit the fan and yes, we may need your brain power on That Great Business Show again. Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Subscribe today to That Great Business Show on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple and Spotify.
Do you know what happens to all of those empty shaving foam cans? 20 million, yes, 20 million of them are sent to landfill every year, and that's just in Ireland. It's a complete disgrace and completely unnecessary. One bottle of De Facto shaving oil is the equivalent of 10 cans of shaving foam. Switching from foam to the world's best shaving oil is the simplest thing you could do to help keep our planet clean. DeFactoShave.com, saving the planet, one shave at a time.
Backing great women-led businesses on every show.
Great Business Show.
Gorey-based Niamh Byrne is my next guest. She's boss at Ruby Rouge, a fashion store that, like all others, was shut by COVID. According to Niamh, COVID has changed fashion buying forever, with no trade shows and so much being done online. That Great Business Show is always banging on about the need to digitize every part of a business. But what happens if the software you need doesn't exist? For example, digitizing fashion buying. Well, the true entrepreneur makes her own, as Niamh Byrne did, creating buyerpicks.com, and she's getting ready to sell it to the global fashion industry. Welcome to That Great Business Show, Niamh.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we are delighted. Anybody who hasn't seen Niamh should look at the Instagram account. She did the best piece, I think, so far, piece to camera. You should be on the stage.
Well, in some ways I am in my everyday world. We do a lot of social media content, a lot of video content, and, you know, it's extremely important for the business. So that's how I reach my customer these days. That's how I speak with them and interact with them.
And your customers aren't coming into the shop. They will very shortly. Oh, actually, have you opened the shop again?
No, we are completely online for the moment.
Okay, well, for the moment or forever, maybe?
Perhaps. It's such a changeable market. We're certainly feeling our way through that. We've had such a good run with the online since we closed the physical store. And we've had to, I suppose, focus our resources there because we have grown so much this year. So,
which kind of makes my mind wonder. You are based in Gorey County, Wexford. Ruby Rouge was your physical outlet. So I understand people, women, I think mostly, going by, they see, there's Ruby Rouge, I must go in there. Now, how are you actually grabbing them to buy from you now?
You know what? It's the same old way that you do everything. It's just a different medium. So it's communicating with our customers in the way that they understand and they like. It's been very conversational with them. It's been as honest as possible with them. And it's given them as much information as we can about the product. And we also, you know, do a lot of interesting content creation. So customers, they resonate with that. They love it. They know our brand. They trust our brand. And they're happy to try it out.
And that's brand Ruby Rouge.
Yes.
So I go on to Ruby Rouge and I say, I want to buy, you're today wearing a very nice paisley two-piece. I want to buy that. I know what happens next. People say, how much? You say, whatever, 100, 200, 400. And everybody, I presume, goes and sees whether they can buy it cheaper. Yes? No?
Well, you see, we do offer a boutique selection. So we offer over 50 brands. And they're my selection from all around the world. So it's a very eclectic mix. Yes, of course, you could buy it from alternative e-commerce websites and other stores. But, you know, a lot of our brand is about our girl next door appeal, the fact that we offer great service and a great after sales service. So it's all aspects of the business that you would do in store, but you just do it better and better again.
So go back to my other question, which was, I understand that you're going to, if not just a Gorey audience, you're going to have a Wexford audience, maybe a South Wicklow audience, because they will know of you.
Yes.
Now, how far away are people buying from you at the moment?
Sydney, Australia, Canada,
Dubai. How do they find you? I love this. And because you're going to impart great insights to That Great Business Show.
Well, you know something, the online world opens up your world.
I love.
We have so much ability now to reach a worldwide audience. Like, it really excites me because obviously when you're in a regional town, you're in a particular location, people do travel and they did travel to us and they always did from the north, from everywhere. We're a real destination boutique and I always love that about our boutique. But the thing is, when you're online, you can reach everybody, everywhere. There is no limits. And that's the most exciting part about it. If you create great content and you have amazing products and you sell it well and you show it to the customers in a relatable way, they will buy it no matter where they are. So we've lots of expats. We've lots of customers that can't get that typical mix of eclectic labels that they could get in Ireland. They can't maybe get that in Canada. You know, it's a lot of the bigger chain stores, a lot of the designer brands, etc. So we have a huge amount of expats and a huge amount of new customers that we've never met.
I'm going to say something very nice about Irish and Irish fashion and Irish fashion shops. I think they're considerably better than what you'll get probably across North America, for example.
That would definitely be the feedback that we would get. Mm. And like definitely when people are home, you know, that live abroad and they come back, they would often come into the store and they would say, they would stock up, they'd make a special trip and they'd say, you know, we can't get this where we live. So we're really excited to have this eclectic mix.
Give me some of your top tips about what softwares are you using within the shop. We'll get on to buyer picks in a second now, but what are you using and what's the best ones that you've found?
Well, we use Shopify. You know, that is our main retail platform that we use for our e-commerce. But we use, we have evolved Buyer Picks now. We have a back in stock function on it. So we used a different software program. We've now developed that ourselves. So we tend to take things in-house where we can and use them that way. So obviously we use all the social media platforms that you can use and all the packages.
What's the best?
Well, for us at the moment, it's Instagram. Yeah. You know, that's where it's at in our particular business. But Facebook is still very strong and you can't dismiss it. You've always got a bit of TikTok coming in there and there's new things coming on stream all the time.
Which is the problem. And we had Amy Connolly on from Sculpted by Amy, and she said that at 28 that she was too old for Instagram. And she grew up and she developed a fantastic business on Facebook.
Yes.
And your problem is, what comes after Instagram? Instagram is still going full belt anyway.
Full belt, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's always something around the corner. The great thing is my team are young, they're vibrant. They often tell me, you know, I've often got a call, Niamh, this TikTok thing is really taken off. You need to look at it. You know, we did that. It worked. We gained some audience there. So I think, you know, they're all similar things, just in different packages.
Is that team that you refer to, are they outsourced or are
no,
they?
No, with in-house, yeah. We've a lot of different age groups that work within the team. We've 11 employees in total. So we've got the cross mix there. And yeah, they're always got their fingers on the pulse and watching out for what's coming next. And yeah, you know, I'm 44, so I'm a bit more of a dinosaur in the tech department. But they know exactly what's coming up next.
Well, that's a perfect segue, because I was going to ask you, what is your tech background?
Well, I actually worked for a software company when I came out of college.
Doing what?
It was a payments solutions company. No, so I was in the marketing. In the marketing department, yeah. But my husband is a techie. And that's where I met him. He's a pure techie, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that explains the next part, buyer picks.
Yes.
What's it do?
Basically, it digitizes the buying function for any fashion retailer.
Because it is a nightmare.
It is.
Why is it a nightmare?
It's a nightmare from start to finish. So at its very basic level, when the trade shows are there, when you're going to physical appointments through agents, etc., you arrive, you know, you may or may not have a budget. You go in, you take your photographs, you make your selection with the designer, etc., etc. So where does all that information go? Well, basically back in your handbag on handwritten order sheets. You know, it's still very archaic, the fashion world. So when you come to, I suppose, collating your whole collection and making edits and cuts, how do you know what to cut? How do you know what to edit? You don't know how many of anything you have. You don't know if you've covered the size range. You don't know if you have 10,000 jumpsuits or five. You know, it's very, very difficult. And I used to find myself, because I'd have over 50 labels, I used to find myself going to these shows, spending large amounts of money and coming back with really handwritten dockets in Italian, Spanish, French. Where do you go from there? And the problem is, I am the conduit into the whole business. And I am the person that does the buying. I'm the person that sees the product. I'm the person that knows all of this great key information. But my team need to know it as well. So my accounts people need to know it. They need to know when to queue up stock to bring it in. What's seasonal? What's timely? Is it fur? Is it a coat? Is it a top? How can they tell that from just a piece of paper with nothing on it? And it's the same for my social media girls. They need to be able to plan a shoot. They need to be able to say, okay, you know, it's going to be sunny at the weekend. Let's make sure we get that in. Let's queue that up and have that ready and have all that content there. They can't do that if they don't know what's coming in. It's all blind. Often when you're buying, things are arriving into store, so you're out of store, you're abroad, you may not see the delivery. It could come in completely the wrong colour. You know, it's stuff like this. It seems very basic, but all that great, fabulous information that makes the business tick and make the business tick well is all based around the buying function. And if that's not utilised by the team correctly, you're missing a major trick.
I would have thought, and I'm wrong so often, so don't be surprised at this, I would have thought that somebody would have come up with this before.
Yes and no, because we've been searching for a solution. It would have been a lot less expensive for us to find one that worked.
And what was the conversation? You're sitting at home with the hubby and you say, listen, this is a nightmare. Can you fix it?
Yeah, you know, he watched me struggle. And that's, you know, he's a techie. He's a software developer with huge talent. And Yeah, I have to say that. And he could see that I was struggling with this so much. And, you know, we had digitized so many other aspects of the business. I mean, the accounts, everything, the social media. And this was the one part that we just couldn't fix. And he was like, you know, I'm going to write you an app for that. I'm going to write you a very simple app. So that was the beginning notes of it. You know, since then, we have come on quite a journey because, you know, that was the buying, I suppose, collating and organizing and keeping keeping things on track and on budget. Because also it's complicated by the fact that you buy forward 6 months in advance, you buy in season 3 month cycles, and you buy for on demand product. So you can imagine how your budgets go totally askew when you're a fashion buyer. It's very difficult to remember what's coming out of what budget if you're not tracking it in any effective way. And if you overbuy, it doesn't matter how much you sell, you ruin your season. So, you know, that was the real reason. I suppose he was looking at me struggling with this, sitting at nighttime with spider graphs of big pages stuck together, trying to hand draw collections to make some sort of order and some sort of, you know, I suppose, intelligence on the piece. And it was just so hard to do, you know? Because you can duplicate your buying. You can buy the same thing from every collection. And then when it arrives in, you're like, oh, I already have five black jumpsuits. I don't need another set of another five more from another collection, you know. 6 months have passed.
There's
a
lovely expression in the software industry when you're at startup stages. What is the addressable market? How big is the market?
I think, to be honest, the market that we're going after is large but niche. So, like, it's a worldwide market. It's definitely in the fashion arena because that's what we know. That's the problems that we're solving here because we live it and breathe it every single day. And I think it could be any customer that's similar to me, my size, right up to a much larger retailer that has all these problems and no solutions either. So it's quite a large market. It's a huge market.
Put a value on it.
Oh, goodness, you're pushing me now.
I mean, we're millions?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes,
that is
the worldwide.
You'll be out of fashion in two years' time. You're about to launch this in July because we wanted to bring it to the attention of the world ahead of anybody else.
Yes.
And then what's the plan? I mean, how do you then market not your clothes? How do you market your software?
Well, this of course, is always the starting point that every entrepreneur is, you know, facing into. And, you know, we're taking a very logical roadmap. Basically, you know, we are starting out from what we know and working outwards. So we know our Irish market. We know our similar businesses within our competitors within our space that need this product. We know other businesses that
have you knocked on their doors yet?
Not yet, because we're finalising it. We want to make sure we have it fully tested in our own business. And we're very much at the end of that point now.
Well, somebody that I know who knows your product very well says it is fantastic. So that's a good start.
Yeah.
Kind of, would you actually imagine yourself getting out of the fashion world and going into the huge world of tech?
You know something, I definitely can. I always love my fashion. I'll always love it. It's a huge part of me. It's part of everything I do, live, breathe, eat. I mean, Ruby Rouge it's a baby almost within the family, and it'll always be part of our business and always be part of us. But I really, really love the idea of branching out into the software world because I know this solution is so valuable to real businesses and they can increase their revenue and make more money. And, you know, I know the amount of effort that we've put into it. I know what it can do for my business. I have seen my business transform by using it. And, you know, it's a very exciting road to be going on as well, a very exciting journey.
If you have done those calculations, you must have an idea. You don't have to give me specific numbers, but something approximating is how much wastage have you cut down on? How big is your margin grown? Any of those metrics?
Well, we've definitely increased our turnover by over double in the last 12 months.
But due to that software?
Yeah. Yeah.
Get away.
And obviously there's other mitigating factors like the environmental factors, and maybe that has helped propel us on. But I can't underestimate this. Yeah, because it's intelligent buying. And this is the thing, what I described initially was how we started off, and where we've come to now is a slightly different route in the sense that we have added in a lot of artificial intelligence. We have added in the
such
analytics.
As what does the artificial intelligence
so,
do?
So, for example, we do a shoot and we upload the images and the sales obviously start to come in. We can actually see, like, straight away how many page views, what product people have looked at the most, what product people have bought the most, obviously what they have returned the most, and why they have returned it. So all this information is key to any retailer when they're either ordering more or indeed they need to know why they're not selling something and what's not selling. There's so much wastage in the industry. So, like, for me, I have like that quick dashboard view and I can see on a daily basis. So now,
tell me the truth. Do you sit in bed watching this?
I have to say I'm a little bit addicted. Yeah, I'm more than a little bit addicted. Yes.
And do you sit in bed at 2 a.m. looking to see, oh my God, we sold something in Australia?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get great fun from that. I get great fun from that. And yeah, no, I do really enjoy that aspect of it. And, you know, you get a great thrill, you know, from it. And
you're selling while you sleep. I love
yeah,
the idea
and,
of that.
You know, like it's also the marketing that goes into it on a daily basis. I mean, you know, I did marketing in college and I worked in marketing. And when you can implement something like a campaign and see the direct results, there's something great about that, you know.
And that
you can
is
use
part of your software.
Completely.
As you correctly say, it is this dashboard.
Yes, yes.
And it is
yeah.
telling you exactly what's selling well.
Yeah. yeah.
What's not. So you get rid of that.
Exactly.
So you say you doubled now the revenues.
Over doubled. Yeah, yeah.
Increased the margin.
Well, I suppose we'll have to do more of a recce on that, but definitely because we have different cost base now. Do you know what I mean? So absolutely. And we're also cutting down the things that aren't selling well and we're going more towards the stuff that's really selling.
How many returns roughly were you seeing in any particular line? I mean, this can be very,
yeah,
very high.
It can really range. You know, I think before we had the software and before we were more laser focused on what exactly we were buying and what exactly we were selling, because that sounds kind of ridiculous. But when you have a huge amount of products and you're on a shop floor and you're between the two, you can really miss, you know, what's still sitting there, why it hasn't sold. How many did you buy originally? Definitely, like, you know, we have a much more bird's eye view all of the time. So I would say I have, you know, I have 360 vision now, whereas before I was kind of going around in the dark. You know, I really couldn't see what was going on and what was moving and what wasn't.
That area of returns brings me back to something that I learned a couple of years ago. One of those big catalog companies,
yeah.
they have 800 people returning on their returns just for the shoes. Somewhere
yeah.
north of England. I mean,
yeah.
that's the size of a town.
Returns can range from 20% upwards to 60%. And it depends really on, as I said, if you're buying products that aren't selling and not realising it and continuing to do that, then you'll have a higher return. We've got ours down now, very, very niche. It's down around the 20, 25% mark.
And Puss must hate you.
Well, we're one of their biggest customers. They actually love us because they have a return pal service that we use. So we're bringing in revenue for them as well.
And then I learned, only before we came on air, that this is not just aimed at the fashion industry. You've got much bigger ideas.
Yeah, well, you can use this software in any industry where you're buying unique products that you need to sell. So, I
such
mean,
as?
Giftware, you know, interior. There's lots of different areas.
No, you say such as that, but you know, I'm not thinking along those lines. So you better, you have no idea. There is a worldwide audience to that great business show. Somebody down in South Africa, somebody down in Australia may be listening and saying, I'd love to have that.
Yes, well, I think when you're buying anything unique
such as,
is constantly changing, so something that is not a regular thing that you buy all the time, you're not working off of listings, you're not working off standardized suppliers. Basically, with me, I don't have one supplier that I had when I opened 16 years ago. And I've had an ever-changing pool of over 50 suppliers every single season. So that's the cyclical, changeable nature of fashion. Anything that's image-based as well, because images are key in this. Like those high-resolution images, they cost so much to generate. And half the time, the retailers aren't even getting them. This is so frustrating. With buyer picks, we can actually save that data. We can split out PDFs. You can have those images there. You can put them straight up onto your Shopify system. Like that is time saving. The amount of money it costs to pay somebody to model, I do this all the time so I know, and get all those gorgeous clothes on them and take those images. Like it's a lot of money, time, effort. You've got to have someone, you know, doing the camera work. You've got to have somebody there modeling. So saving retailers, that is huge. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that there's great leverage in those images.
I shared the pain with Annalise Stuffy of the linen shirt company about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, because she has to go off and she has just done it. It's up on social media. She's joined us on That Great Business Show a few weeks back and she was shooting again to re-image her lovely, lovely linen shirts.
Yeah.
So, what about money? Funding? You need funding or can you grow it as you are?
Immediately at this moment, we don't need funding. We have received investment from Enterprise Ireland and we're using that at the moment to finish out our platform on the tech side. But
which
obviously, if we want to
scale. Which fund did you tap into? Is that CSF or competitive
CSF.
Startup fund?
That's right. Yes, yes.
And
which
what about
brilliant.
You could get the matched funding next if you wanted to?
And that's what we would be hoping for. We're moving towards that. We certainly are open to talk to anybody that would be interested in investing us. And we would really look at pushing to look at investment towards the end of this year and into next year.
Interesting, because I have an idea for you that I'll share with you.
Great.
I'm hoping to have an extraordinary person from the fashion industry on. The call has gone out. I won't mention anything more than that because I have been waiting a while. but that would be the perfect, what we call clever money or wise money that you might need.
Okay, excellent.
Final question, which probably feeds into the same thing. Who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Gosh, I think the first person that would come to my mind would be Sonia Lennon. She is inspirational. I've had great opportunity to work with her over the years. She's a real style icon. She understands the industry inside out, from the consumer right through to design, right through to software development. So it would be amazing. She'd be my dream team. And of course, I'd have to mention Brendan Courtney because they come as a pair.
And I love her glasses. They are, I was looking at her for some reason the other day. They are big glasses, aren't they?
Fantastic. She always makes a statement every time she enters the room, and we all love that in fashion.
And she's got a big smile on her face as well, which is nice as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Great. Niamh Byrne, I don't know which to call you. Do you go by Ruby Rouge or do you go by Biopix?
Most people think my name is Ruby, so you can call me Ruby from Biopix. Get it all in.
It's biopix.com, P-I-X.
P-I-X, yes, x.com. So Niamh@biopix.com if anybody has any queries or would like to try.
No, not this. This is Team GBS. They're going to come along with a big fat check and they're going to say, we want in and we want in now.
Excellent.
This is like the Dragon's Den, except it's the reverse. You just name your price and they say, oh, we want to give you more money, more money. Niamh, thanks so much for joining us here.
Thank you so much.
Canobio. At That Great Business Show.
You're listening to That Great Business Show. ThatGreatBusinessShow.com.
Do the right thing. Ditch dirty, polluting, non-recyclable shaving foam. Switch to DeFactoShave.com. The only shaving product you need. One nail varnish size bottle lasts a year. Great for your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
That Great Business Show.
One of the reasons why I find sports pundits in the media so tedious is they are so often wrong. And I carry that curmudgeonly view to most business forecasters as well. I think it's safe to say that few, if any of us, are any good at predicting the future. Now, having cleared the air on that issue, it doesn't mean that we on That Great Business Show don't try to find those we believe might actually have some intelligent insight, like Ciarán Rossum, CEO of FlexTime, a company set up a long, long time ago to sell the idea of flexible working. FlexTime develops time management solutions to enable flexible, remote and shift working in businesses and institutions of all sizes. The company of 20, and they are hiring, operates in Ireland, the UK and across Europe, serving 400 clients with a total of 200,000 employees. Ciarán Rossum, you are most welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thanks very much, Connell.
You know something, or maybe a lot, about flexible working. And you knew this before COVID happened. And I presume you sneer at people who became overnight experts on it, the way we are all overnight experts on things like AstraZeneca jabs. But you actually do know something about it.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you the impossible. What's the future?
Yeah, the future is, I'm going to predict it, is more flexibility. Because when we started out at the very early days, it was a long time ago, as you say.
Years ago?
It was 40 nearly years ago.
Okay, yeah. So that's what I mean. You know what you're talking about.
In actual fact, we have a direct link back through time, if you excuse the expression, time is, again, back to 1967 when the very original flexible working hour scheme started in Germany in a company called Messerschmitt, who were quite well known in another era. And they had problems with people coming on and off the plant. You know, they were kind of queuing up in their cars, and they decided to ask somebody to research what this could be. And they got in a sociologist, a woman actually, with that little womanly touch, as it were. And she thought the idea of why 9, why 5? And from that moment onwards, if you like, the Berlin Wall of time fell.
And fair play to her, because it is such an obvious question. Mm. I had a philosophy teacher called Dr. Fergal O'Connor, who asked fundamental questions like that as why?
Why?
So I love those people.
Yeah.
And what was the answer to why 9 to 5?
Well, the answer to why 9 to 5 was something else, and it was flexibility. They had a very quaint name for it at the time, glide sight, which is gliding time. And
that was their solution to it. But I presume originally 9 to 5 happened because the sun rises and sun sets. And we used to be out in the field.
Probably the Industrial Revolution.
Whatever,
people had to be on shifts. And you know, back as far as the 1800s, Levi Strauss and companies like that did record time. But this was a paradigm shift whereby you're being given choice over your working hours. So you could, the original schemes were about just the working day and not the facility to build up time. That came later, and that would be called a flexi day, where you could build up time once a month, say, and take a flexi or 2 days off. But originally it was all around, can I arrive in between 8 and 10, any old time, as it were, and then work my core, take my lunch, a long lunch or a short lunch, and in the afternoon I would have to work a core, and then I could go home from 4 or work up as far as 6:30.
And the interesting thing about that is now we almost take that for granted, don't we?
We do.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the time it was, you know,
revolutionary. In fact, I think it was beyond revolutionary. I think it was the end of the world, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, exactly. Because I remember coming to Ireland and with the idea, you know, it came over from Germany to me when we set up our company, and you felt like St. Patrick in a way. Because people really didn't know much about flexible working at the time. And certainly, you know, people jealously regard their time, you know, as regards to, it's the second most important thing to their heart after their pay, if you like. So therefore, it's difficult to muck around with it. And also managers will be quite nervous at the time in terms of, you know, changing the rule book on working time. But that took quite a number of years persuasion. Obviously, we don't live on thin air. We can't just persuade people about concepts and talk to management, talk to unions, talk to staff representatives and the staff as well. We have to do a lot of that, but we obviously can't only do that. And that's why we came into designing our system for flexible working.
And you told me a lovely story about the unions and about how you ended up working with them. You may as well
share. I did indeed, yeah, because after a while when we were negotiating, we occasionally, you know, bumped into the unions. They would come to meetings or whatever, our staff representatives.
They were probably worried about you, that you're evil, that you're trying to extract an extra half hour out of people.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, comparatively, the Irish unions are very positive. And I say that in comparison to other countries that we've had a little bit of knowledge of. And they were extremely positive on this particular issue. They were on the side, obviously, of the employee, but equally, it worked well between negotiations. And you know, I don't want to paint a picture that it was always the unions. It would be just in certainly the bigger corporates or the semi-states, state bodies, and say financial institutions had them, but lots of other companies didn't. But the story that happened to us in relation to them, that they themselves started to get interested in flexible working for their own staff. And we now have our system in Congress, for example, and quite a few of the trade unions.
And you also have your system in Dáil Éireann.
We do indeed.
Trying to keep our politicians on the straight and narrow.
That's right. Yeah, that example actually, the Oireachtas is a good one from the point of view that our system can be bought off the shelf, or it can be added to. So you can imagine we've already got 40 years of experience laden inside that with switches to turn things on and to, you know, modify and to go along with the culture in each individual organisation. But then you'll also get a request to do something that's slightly outside the box. So after we put the system into the Oireachtas for their staff, for flexible working, we were then asked, what about, would you be interested in also another project? And interestingly, we got the go-ahead from the 9 o'clock news because we had to tune in one night and the newscaster, I think it was Anne Doyle, I was back that while, and she said, tomorrow, soon the TDs and the members will be recording in the system for their expenses. So we designed a special program for them, and it's still there now. So,
you know. And I won't even ask you to go into the little scams that how they've got around it and all the rest. However, let's get back to the future. Mm-hmm. You very interestingly mentioned the, you know, why 9 to 5. Here's a question, because I've only just thought of it.
Yeah.
Is why the weekend? Why don't we work weekends? You know, give me Tuesday and Wednesday off or whatever.
Yeah, it is true that there is, if you like, not enough regard for that, because, you know, it can suit a lot of people. And it's proven now with the COVID situation that, you know, mum works in the morning, dad works in the afternoon, and vice versa, they manage the kids. And actually working on Saturday may seem anti-family, but in a weird way, it isn't, because it introduces an extra day into the 7 day cycle, as it were, you know. So it's something that has been underreported. It's a good idea that you've mentioned there. Yeah, it is something that should and could be looked at. Again, you don't want to be anti the individual. And it can only be negotiated.
For the individual. It might work for the individual. Yeah.
Sometimes these things that seem the opposite can have a curious way of working well. We've always found that it has to be negotiated, no matter what we do. There's not a one size fits all, and there would be generalized type rules in relation to flexible working hours that were kind of from the rule book and HR management, CIPD, and these sorts of organizations would, have a kind of a general consensus of what it is. But then within that, there would be lots of breakouts, if you like, and changes and variabilities around organizations and even within organizations.
So more flexibility is what you are predicting, and I think we'll accept that.
Yeah, I think we're seeing it, yeah.
Can you, using your system or, a world system, get around things like why the school time starts at 9 o'clock?
Yeah.
And it always...
Yeah, I'm a frustrated citizen in that regard too.
Yeah.
And again, it's something slightly outside our remit because... We are tending to work with organisations and companies and the likes and state bodies. And
but do you think they're sitting in the bath? Do you think about all these issues?
I do, yeah. And I often said that...
What's the answer?
Yeah, well, it's back to the same idea, flexibility and, flexible scheduling in their case. They would have to schedule, obviously, and to have, core periods maybe, and also at the beginning and the end of each day, which they do to an extent, to have these study times, but more of that. And really, I wonder why they don't open at different times more often, starting from, say, 7 in the morning up to whatever, But those sorts of ideas could be looked at. And some of the schools are doing some of that sort of thing,
Where will flexibility end? As in, how flexible can we become? And the other obvious one that every politician, I was going to say politician, you have me thinking about your politicians, your employers, they're always thinking of the employee scamming the time somehow. Mm.
Yeah. Well, the first question, how flexible can it become? And I haven't found any boundaries in terms of it, because what we keep finding, we're dealing with a local authority in North Wales, and they would have 2,500 staff on our, if you like, formal flexible working with all the built-in rules. And they came to us about 2 years ago and said, actually, we are working on an agile working principle to do with how people work, and they wanted to match that with the way they did their time, and they wanted to actually remove most of the constraints. So therefore, in theory, an employee could come in to work at 4 in the morning, go home, collect the kids, bring them to school, and come back to work for a short while later on.
I love the idea of that. Mm. So I'm a very early riser.
And there's our weekend idea too.
Yeah. And the... You can record their ins and outs.
Yeah.
But what about the actual productivity? That's not on your system, is it?
Not really. We do try to kind of step away from being overly controlling with what we're doing. We're more kind of there as persuaders.
You were going to call yourself Big Brother, were you?
Yeah, exactly. We're light touch, and we're trying to encourage people.
Yeah.
To at the end of the day, it's the whole thing is designed to allow the employee a modicum of flexibility so that they can have their work-life balance, And now there are aspects of it that whereby, particularly now we're going into the next phase with home working, or it's already there, as we all know, but the next phase will be return to work. So with the idea of the hybrid working location, people might start to say, well, I would also like to know a little bit of about what you're doing. And the system can do that sort of thing. Now,
I'm interested in that. How can it tell? If I'm writing a document, for example, does that document show in somebody else's monitor and they can see he's written 200 words in the last 10 hours?
Yeah, well, we don't go down to that kind of close level. Now, most of our schemes don't do it at all, but some of them are starting to do, a generalized description of what I'm doing. And I mean, that can be two ways. Some people might say, well, that sounds controlling. But then on the other hand, there is evidence that the employee is isolated and they would like their supervisor to know what they're doing for encouragement. Am I gone on the wrong tangent? Am I doing the wrong work?
As a former employer used to say to me frequently, inform as you perform.
Mm, yeah,
and that's always stuck with me because you do need to tell somebody, like, I'm not out the back drinking coffee and whatever. Yeah. I'm actually working here.
I'm actually working. And also I might need guidance because, for example, I could have gone off on a tangent and I haven't realised it. So we're actually looking at that ourselves to see if we can help on that soft side of it rather than controlling what the person is doing, but to see if we can help and encourage people to do their work.
And my other question stands, how flexible is flexible? How flexible could we finally go? I mean...
Yeah, well, that example I was giving you there in North Wales, they decided to lift all the strictures. And what they found was that they were looking for people to come to work from far away because they were, say, it was quite a rural area. So they thought, well, one way of doing this is to offer ultra flexibility. And maybe people from Liverpool, which is not that far from North Wales, and even Manchester with motorways can offer... we can offer them flexibility. And so therefore, that was an example of whereby all the you know, the strictures were removed from the flexible working day. Now, it isn't that easy because some organisations, we've got our Haddington Road rules and all of those things as well. So, but nonetheless, we can see that every time there's a crisis, after the crash, we had Haddington Road, and after COVID, what did we have? We had home working. So it's been culturally changed by outside forces.
Here's a question completely from left field because you don't have to answer it at all. If you don't have to come into work, if I have saved you an hour's journey, either which way, that's 2 hours times five, who owns that 10 hours? Does that belong to the employer or the employee? Mm-hmm. Or is there room for negotiation? Could an employer start saying, ah, come on, you know, give us an extra hour there. I've saved you having to come in.
Yeah, well, it's true. Well, historically, it's always been outside. It's been on the employee's side. But now that things have changed, I think there is a scope for negotiation on around a lot of these issues. And one of them is to do with travel time, and the other one is to do with location. And I mean, we've done studies. We do regular studies. Like when I say regular, I mean every few years because we don't have the time to do major studies every week. But we do minor studies very, very regularly. We do sort of vox pops of our customers to see what do you think of this. And it's very, very informative and helps us to inform our system.
How do you do that? What do you use?
We would use something like SurveyMonkey, something very simple, you know. Okay. And
there's a little insight now, a little tip for all businesses. There's nothing to stop you from doing
that. Absolutely. It's the best way to find out what people are really thinking before you go off designing stuff that may not be relevant. And I found the whole way through COVID, people's minds, as we all know, were changing depending on what the HSC were telling us and so forth. So all during last summer, it was all about home working. And then the return to work started to come about. And in the last few weeks, it's been, oh, we may be returning to work. So I think we're going back to work.
As I pointed out some weeks ago, Goldman Sachs are going back to work. And if Goldman Sachs set a standard, everybody thinks they have to match that. Two quick questions. One being the for flex time, you are hiring. You're obviously expanding. Where is the next big expansion?
Yeah, with us, we focused most of our time for the last years on complex flexibilities, if I can put it that way, and corporates, large state bodies, smaller companies as well, but always around a rule-based complexity. But there's a new cohort out there, and that is people who are not influenced by any of those things. They've never used a time system. They've never had the challenge of...
Such as? You know, what kind of businesses?
There will be small to medium-sized organisations, maybe new companies just been set up in the last 4 years, all these new things, as they say, you know. And they've got no prejudgment on these issues, but they do have the issues, and the issues are growing. The state is saying, you know, the right to disconnect. It's saying this, that and the other, European Act on working time. Meanwhile, you know, paternity leave, maternity leave, job sharing, job...
Oh, you love all this. You're probably at the back making up these rules.
Yeah, so I'm egging them on.
So answer me about where's your next big growth outside of those? Are you going to go to Europe? Are you UK? I mean, you're in both. But
we're majoring a lot in the UK at the moment. We're just opening our office in Manchester to kind of embed the work we've already got. We've got some very big projects like the HMPO. They're all the passport offices throughout the UK. So and the entire workforce.
We're going to run out of time, but you have to just name check. You're cooperating with a Northern Ireland company on the...
Equinity are hosting our... So there's a North-South cooperation. Fantastic
thing. We love
that.
You know?
And just the future is we're working on a new project for the non-corporate people, the guy who wakes up in the morning... And he says, oh, how can I manage a 15 to 20 to 25 staff? I'm new, but I still have all these things coming into me from legislation, paternity, maternity, job sharing, job timing, flexible working, you know, and how am I going to manage all this? And we're doing a light touch, solution.
You've got that lovely big smile sitting in his window going, I'm here.
Yeah.
Final question, hire in a heartbeat. Who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Well, I think you're thinking about who would I, you know, obviously I'm not going to say Santa Claus, but I would say Daniel Ek. He's the head guy in Spotify.
Okay.
Now,
I do know who you mean. He's going to buy Arsenal, isn't that right?
Yeah, and he's a Swedish man. And, you know, he was the guy who got in after Napster started to disappear. Yeah. And his attitude was that if we make a legitimate version of music download, we can pay the artists and also we can get it out there. And it was it is controversial as regards to the artists will have lost money. And I'm not saying that. I'm more saying that I love the technology aspect of it, of how it got out there. So that's, we're designing a new system, which is exactly in that mode for time, which is very simple for mom and dad shops around the world. And very easy to use. You can self-download it yourself, get yourself up going within, you know, maybe a couple of hours. You don't need our project team for that part of the work. It would be just literally for the organization or the man who or the woman who buys it to set it up themselves, and within an hour they're working.
And do you know who else uses Spotify?
We do. Oh, very good.
We are on all the good platforms, but in particular, Spotify is very strong in the US. Apple iTunes, it's now called Apple Podcast, would be the absolute market leader.
Yeah.
But Spotify is coming hard outside.
But they are a good example
of
a technology company that's done something good. As I say, the artistic aspect, I'm not 100% in that, but definitely they're a good tech company.
Ciarán Rossum, CEO of FlexTime, Ireland and Europe, or multi-time as you are in the UK. Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from That Great Business Show on this, our 36th episode. My thanks to all the team here at the Dublin South FM podcast studios, including, yes, she's back, Alison O'Dwyer on sound. Peter Rice could be dropping your ads into our podcast later on. If you would like to advertise with us, do get in touch. As well as being Ireland's best business podcast, we are also the world's best sounding podcast, and that's official. My thanks to our great Team GBS friend, Pat Flynn of Flynn O'Driscoll Business Lawyers, for sending Declan Lacey our way. Another big backer of our team, Maeve Neefsey, recommended Niamh Byrne, and Nikki Crichton chased and chased in the nicest possible way to make sure we got to hear Ciarán Rossum's great story. Buíochas mór libh ar fad. If you know of a great company that should or could be featured on Ireland's Best Business Podcast, do send producer@thatgreatbusinessshow.com an email and we will take it from there. Please also do tell all of your friends about That Great Business Show. You wouldn't want them to miss out now, would you? We are very big on LinkedIn. Find us on LinkedIn, where we now have chats almost every day. Finally, my thanks to our sponsor, DeFactoShave.com, the world's best shaving oil. Try it for a week, and you will be, like me, a forever convert. So from me, Conal O'Moran, until next week, Slán tomhach.